Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Zombie Myths of Australian Military History, Chapter 9. So out of 10 chapters, we're 90% of the way through, and we're up to Vietnam, which all these things sort of, if you wanted to really connect with an Australian, you'd talk about the military exploits, because this is the fabric upon which we build our national identity. Well, it's not individuals, but as a community, if we want to announce something, we have to stitch it into an existing fabric. And of course, people like a virus and DNA can actually put in these bits of DNA into our identity. It becomes part of our identity, and we find it hard to overcome. So we've come through a whole series of rather embarrassing myths, or say like the Kokoda Trail, that was just putting that into perspective, not over magnifying it. The myth of the invasion or the Battle of Australia is a complete fiction, but is a central tenet of the belief going forward. And it's one of these sticky things. We want to honour people who and take them seriously, make something inclusive. We don't want to have lots of enemies, newcomers, people deriding Australia will deride these myths. It's sort of an easy target for them, and things can often get misinterpreted. And now we come to the Vietnam War, which is by far, if you're a Vietnam vet, you are a sacred commodity in Australia. And we lost 550 people all up, RAN, Australian Navy, Air Force, 550. Most of those were traffic accidents or misfortune of a large number of people with heavy equipment. Some, 50 to 70 maximum, would have died in combat, which Americans lost in single days of fighting. So, it's In Every War But One, Myth, History and Vietnam by Jeffrey Graham. Now, I should note before I go on that although I'm reading this, the actual hidden agenda is to be able to read for longer periods of time before my reading quality goes off and my cognitive ability increases. And I was quite amazed to actually hit 140 minutes, whereas previously my sort of record is about 40, 50 minutes at max before I start going off. So that was a significant improvement. And this is a second stint in one day. I may even polish off this book today, as the sort of family does activities and sort of indicate that, you know, I'm not wanted in the area. So I'll just go and do this. The Vietnam provides a compelling example of the power of myth in Australian popular culture and the triumph of popular cultural images, many of them American, over the memory of actual events. In truth, is the first casualty of war, then an accurate understanding of past events is, in this case, a close second. The Vietnam War was the most divisive commitment in a generation and polarised sections of the Australian community in a manner not seen since the Great War and the Constitution's debate of 1916-1917. So there was huge fault lines across here, because you have the Irish Catholics in Australia and the people wanting conscription, and so you have the Masons versus the Catholics. There's all these fault lines which went as Britain wanted to just conscript Australians, and we'd already sent over every able-bodied person, so conscripting wouldn't have really done all that much tactically in the war. Okay, it involved the use of national servicemen on active duty overseas, so this is conscripted. The fall of Vietnam, South Vietnam in 1975, and the defeat of US and Western aims in Indochina that resulted presented a temporary setback in the Cold War. But on some readings, at least, the protracted commitment in Vietnam contributed to substantialization of a newly independent nations elsewhere in the region. The course and consequences of the war were generally not well understood at the time.
and this remains the case. This chapter will examine some of the persistent myths about the beliefs about Australian involvement. I argue that Australians do not understand why they became involved, have little accurate idea of what other our soldiers did and why they were there, and continue to subscribe to a variety of beliefs about the effects of service in that war, and later assiduously stoked by groups with a vested interest in perpetuating such beliefs. The overriding misconception is that Vietnam somehow presents a unique occurrence in our history, one that stands aside from the historical developments of the rest of the 20th century. This is simply wrong. One of the most important aspects of the study of history is to understand the context in which a given set of events occurred. An appreciation of context not only helps ascertain the relative importance of these events, but also assists in appreciation of their relative uniqueness or otherwise. If we understood the context of Vietnam, we might be less ready to believe some of the untruths and half-truths propagated about it, and be more sceptical of the ways in which our popular culture has been colonised by that of the US, United States, in this process. Yeah, so the US of Vietnam is very much different from the Australian Vietnam. The United States became involved in Indochina in the second half of the 1940s, partly as a result of the evolution of strategy of containment of communism, which formed a clear and coherent response in the emergence of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. And in the context of the possession of atomic and subsequent nuclear weapons, subsequently nuclear, so they were called atomic, but that's actually incorrect. So an atom doesn't provide the power of a nuclear bomb, a nucleus does. On both sides, as part of the process, the United States increasingly underwrote the cost of the French War in Indochinese colonies in order to secure active French involvement in the defence of Western Europe as part of NATO alliance, formed in 1949. So that's good, that Russia threatening NATO to get France moving, the Americans underwrote Indochina. Pretty amazing. Australian policy in the course of the 1950s produced some involvement in Indochina affairs driven by two considerations. The growing importance of the alliance with the United States, formalised through the ANZUS Treaty of 1951, and a need to contribute to the stability of our immediate region, one that was rent by violent conflicts in a number of places simultaneously. So that's Malaya, the Malaya Emergency, that's going up there. And the interesting thing is that they sort of used similar tactics to the Japanese, making it a police operation. So the Japanese went from conquest to police control, civil control. So they used civil levers to control the civilian population, which is different from what the Americans tend to do. They tend to have soldiers patrolling about the place and, you know, targets and checkpoints and stuff like that. Very interesting. I was thinking of Iraq. The need to contribute to the stability of an immediate region. If American involvement in Vietnam can be understood through the reference to developments in Europe after 1945, Australia's involvements need to be seen as part of a wider concern with strategic developments in our immediate region. Okay, so America's there because it wants France to back Germany for, you know, be a good member of NATO. Australian involvement in the 1950s and 60s in Malaya, Singapore, and during the Confrontasi with Indonesia was similarly a function of these policies and had absolutely nothing to do with the United States, which in fact made it clear that these were areas of concern to the British and Commonwealth and not of Washington, except in a general sense. Yeah, so there's a Malayan emergency where they nearly lost Malaya. I don't know what happened in Singapore, but I do know that the Confrontasi was a fairly big conflict with Indonesia. And there's, I don't know, in the concept of these myths, these mythical operations between Australian forces and Indonesian forces, apparently exchanged fire across the Papua New Guinean frontier. Sort of this background really shaped our involvement in the next chapter, which is Timor. The second myth from our Vietnam involvement stems from the notion that it was a civil war and hence none of our business. The wars in Vietnam, indeed civil conflicts in the obvious sense that the Vietnamese, the Khmers and the Laotians fought each other.
but why this fact itself should render external intervention somehow illegitimate is never explained. Does this mean that external intervention in the civil conflict in Rwanda in the 1990s should not have occurred? Many will argue that it should have happened earlier, more decisively, in order to head off the genocidal massacres perpetuated there. Or that Australian forces have no place being in Malaya in the 1950s, in spite of the fact that when independence came in 1957, the government of Malaya made it explicitly clear that assistance from the Commonwealth partners were welcome. And so Australia inaccurately has a little air force base in Butterworth in Malaya, a legacy of the Japanese invasion, so it's still up there. And we still have planes in regular rotation. And so we fly, for some reason, fighter jets up over Indonesia to the space. And Indonesia knows all about this. And we tell them we're flying overhead. And so it's a big hullabaloo, except these four fighter jets. And I think we struggle a lot. Well, I've heard that we struggle a lot of time to get these four fighter jets to rotate. So we've got a very small, insignificant stuff. And, of course, when the Australian Air Force is used in Iraq and Syria operations, it's a big strain because there's hardly anything left in Australia. And, of course, I think New Zealand, which is way, way out, has just said, what's going on? So I believe New Zealand sold its Air Force, sort of auctioned off its planes, and a lot of the joyriding jets, you can go for a joyride in a jet in Sydney. I shudder to think what the safety of these things are. So these are the old MiGs. So if you're desperate out there to fly a MiG, this is a 1950s MiG. Somehow it went to New Zealand and somehow it's come to these private companies. I don't know what the safety of these things would be, but there you have it. I should put an advertisement there. Vietnam was a civil war, but to describe it as that alone is to fail to comprehend the full complexity of the war itself and our part in it. All this is consistent with the greatest overarching myths of Australian military history, namely that Australia always fights other people's wars. In the historical discourse, this is sometimes identified with the existence of an expeditionary force mentality. In popular terms, it can be summed up by the very wiry observation that, quote, if the United States went to war with Antarctica, Australia would send a battalion to fight the penguins, unquote. According to this line of reasoning, involvement in Vietnam furnishes another lamentable example of our national policy of simply falling into lines with the behest of our greatest and powerful friend, the United States. And of course, we're almost like the level of Guatemala. There you go. We've moved our embassy to East, like this, East Jerusalem. So we recognize East Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, at the same time recognizing West Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. So really set the cat amongst the pigeons. I didn't quite understand what went. Indeed, Vietnam example was raised repeatedly by critics of the House government's decision to deploy forces in Iraq in 2003, another Vietnam. And I think, this is lamentable. Australians have been involved in that. There are two issues to be explored about this argument. The existence of a tradition of acquiescence to the policy of others, and the strategic realities of our history. The notion that Australians have always fought other people's wars rests on the assumption that the wars we have fought were not our national interest. This argument is often also aligned with a highly simplistic notion that the national interest equates solely to the direct defence of the Australian territory. In what way was the defeat of Nazism, fascism and Japanese militarism during World War II none of our business? A victorious Imperial Germany in the Great War would have imposed harsh peace on the defeated British Empire, of which we were part. If readers doubt this, they should look at the German conduct in occupied France and Belgium between 1915 and 1918. Oh, my God, Father. Yeah, that was dreadful. And the peace terms imposed on the defeated Romania and Russia. Just appalling. We scream about Versailles, but yeah, God, this is horrible. Critics have often pointed to the need for Australian governments to pay more attention to the affairs in our own region, that is Asia, by implication away from the historical involvement in the Middle East in the first half of the 20th century that formed part of our contribution to the British imperial strategy. As noted already, this is precisely what the Australian government did in 1950, with a conscious reorientation of strategic policy in response to the instability north. This was driven in part by the realisation of strategic vulnerability exposed by the Japanese advance in 41 to 43, and by the obvious weakening of the British capabilities as a global power in the aftermath of World War II.
Australia's still very heavily involved in the UN, and a lot of my friends went off to Rwanda, majors and various things. Further to this, however, the Australian government has usually pursued a policy that offers defence on the cheap in peacetime, allowing the direction of resources to other uses in the civilian economy. The utilisation of the World Bank loans in the early 1950s to develop national infrastructures such as the Snowy Mountain Scheme is a case in point. Well, there you go. I didn't know the Snowy Mountains Scheme was a World Bank initiative. In general, this seems to have been accorded with electoral expectations. The essential pillar of this policy has been a reliance on allies, and especially an integral integration of Australia's effort with those of the major powers, by turn, Britain and the United States.
Yeah, so we've got a huge amount of dams and railroads to build across this vast brown land of ours, and of course we can't be maintaining this sort of military investment is extremely poor, if you ask me, because a lot of the things you buy are out of date by the time they hit, you unpack them. And you've got to train them, and you've got to sort of like, I think we had F-111s, and there's a whole industry and folklore of people maintaining this. And so we would maintain things, and then at the end of life, we would actually give ships and planes to Indonesia, and they'd not maintain them, and they'd just fall apart almost instantly. It was this. So Indonesia's the big northern, our big northern neighbour. Okay. While this sometimes crudely described as an insurance policy on which payments must be made periodically, in fact the alliance relationships carry with them responsibilities as well as benefit. In Kim Beazley's word, the history of the world we live in is not typically kind to small nations such as ours. A narrow definition of national instruments serves no one interests, while the electorate has never been willing to shoulder the cost or the implications of an independent foreign and defence policy, whatever it may look like. This is an important aspect that we are hopeless in influencing. I think especially when Australians are arrogant, I think that really works against us. And they're not as arrogant as some, and so that really the arrogance cost us so much. Another notion that has gained wider currency in recent years is the argument that, irrespective of the war's actual outcome, we won our war. The idea is tied to a persistent belief in American tactical incompetence in South Vietnam's Vietnamese cowardice, later going hand in hand with corruption and incompetence, it is alleged. In this self-regarding view, the Australians were the only ones who understood the nature of the challenge posed by the enemy, usually described as the Viet Cong, although after 1968, the majority of the enemy soldiers were regulars of the People's Army of Vietnam, the PAVN. While the Viet Cong themselves were organised in several different ways at local, that is, village levels, and more widely within the provinces, as what were designated as main force units. This view also conceals a deep misunderstanding of the nature of the war that was not, in truth, one seamless and unchanging conflict, but in fact several different types of wars fought in different parts of the country simultaneously.
Yeah, so I think that is the if you had to put a finger of it, the Americans lost Vietnam, South Vietnamese lost Vietnam, but we won. Our little section that we won was really quiet, and that what essentially happened is that the Vietnamese had better, softer targets to hit than the Australians, basically. The popular image of the Australian and American soldiers fighting black pyjamas clad guerrillas whose main weapons were stealth, guile and local knowledge is a caricature that one gives insufficient credit to the tough, well-trained, disciplined enemy. Yeah, so was it Firebase Coral and Balmoral? The big ones were pretty main units. In fact, I think the Long Tan was against main units. During the American War, roughly 65 to 72, the fighting in northern province of South Vietnamese came close to conventional military mid-intensity conflicts with heavy use of artillery, airstrikes and armour. The Mel Gibson feature film We Were Soldiers, based on an excellent best-selling account by two participants, demonstrates the conventional infantry nature of combat on both sides. Elsewhere in the country, fighting was often a mixture. I should say the platoon. So I was trained by lots of Vietnam vets. In fact, almost exclusively vet officers from special forces used to be our officers. You know, that I don't know why they were. They were really excellent people, but you got a big, lots and lots of stories and understanding. It demonstrates the conventional infantry nature of combat of both sides. Elsewhere in the country, fighting was often a mixture of conventional combat and the more familiar locally driven guerrilla or insurgent style. In the delta, in the far south of the country, the terrain and the distance for enemy sanctuaries in North Vietnam, Cambodia and Laos maintained that it was the only style of fighting experience. Australian soldiers experienced a range of combat types. Classical guerrilla occupations, operations, villages and hamlets of Phoc Thai province. Main force operations against the NLF, National Liberation Front, or Viet Cong, and the PAVN regulars in areas such as Long Hai Hills, and intense conventional combat at places like Coral Balmoral. Yeah. And Bin Bar, and later utilising Australian tanks in a conventional infantry support role that would have been familiar to veterans of World War II. In the last 2 years of the Australian commitment, the first task force was largely confined to operating in Phoc Thai, and by most accounts, the number, range and intensity of contacts with the enemy force had decreased, as eventually did Australian casualties. It is possible to deduce from the Australian operations in the province had been successful, and the enemy challenge to Saigon government had been defeated there. So there are various reasons. So the Vietnam War just basically they stopped fighting us and we walked away, essentially. It is equally possible, even... likely, in the face of proficient and extended Australian operations, the enemy had withdrawn from the province itself in order to wait out the Australians, since by 1970 at least, it was obvious that the forces had intervened in a war on the side of the Saigon government were in the process of withdrawal. This is an argument advanced by some former NFL today. So we're withdrawing, they sort of said, "All right, you are withdrawing." Yeah, I think they were drawing down since 1970. The ease and rapidity with which the enemy forces moved back in the province after our withdrawal, thus negating such gains as the Australians had achieved, offers support for some later interpretation. In any case, the whole idea of winning our war, divorced from consideration of the wider fortunes of Saigon government, is fatuous and based on a very curious notion of winning. As various commentators have pointed out, it's possible to win major battles and still lose the war, especially in a conflict in which political objectives on one side are unreasonable and otherwise unattainable, as was the case of the American objectives in Vietnam. They had basically an unpopular, puppet, corrupt government. They were just so corrupt, it's just impossible to believe. And of course, you also have to understand that it was Buddhists versus Catholics. So we've got lots of religious Christian Vietnamese coming out. A further respect of the war of Australians actually experienced deserves comment. In any war zone, by definition, is dangerous. The extraordinary range of heavy firepower available to the Americans and the Allies and their willingness to use it made Vietnam a dangerous place, especially on operations. At times, the war surged into urban areas, most obviously during the Tet Offensive in early 1968. Again, during the so-called mini-Tet the following year, during the initial advisory stage of the American war in the early 60s when guerrilla attacks on the US personnel increased, but before any significant numbers of Australian personnel were deployed there. The MOC also regularly rocketed large facilities such as air base at Ben Hua or Tan Son Nhut, and at times launched rockets and mortars offences against major urban centres targeting civilian population. It is often observed that the Vietnam War was a war without front lines. This is literally true if one is in the mind of the static defences of the Western Front, or Tobruk in 1941, or the Jamestown line in the Korean War, but the phrase is often used to imply that there was no area safe from enemy attack, and that downtown Saigon, say, and Vũ Tàu resembled Baghdad at the worst of the current insurgency in 2005-2006. Poor Baghdad. This is a long way from being true. Vũ Tàu provided a major in-country R&R, restaurant recreation facility for the Australians, and large numbers of Australian soldiers spent some large part of their off-duty hours in the town, especially if they were members of the units that formed the 1st Australian Logistics Support Group, which was located there. So did numbers of American servicemen, and if the rumours are to believe, off-duty enemy personnel as well. Australian soldiers on leave wore civilian clothes and were prohibited from carrying firearms. Their personal weapons were left at the base, and although weapons were to be carried at all times within the 1ALSG, they were not loaded. So I don't know what that means. That's our base. Vũ Tàu seems to have offered the usual range of amenities and diversions sought by young men in war enjoying some downtime. It is difficult to believe that military authorities would have allowed soldiers to wander through the town at various hours of the day and night. Curfews existed, but were clearly not always imposed fully successfully, and unarmed if they were subject to regular attack, or indeed allowed to access the town at all, had the environment not been one of constant havoc. War zones are inherently dangerous, but some areas are always more dangerous than others, and some soldiers incur risks and dangers far more frequently than others. Another myth widely believed, and sometimes trotted out in documentaries dealing with the period in Vietnam, was conscripts war, allied to the idea of national service. Conscription, in the euphemism of the day, was introduced specifically, so we call it national service as a conscription. So we had this, the US had conscription, we had conscription. Was introduced specifically to, remember that Einstein was going to be conscripted, The mere commitment to Vietnam. Not only were conscripted militiamen sent to the islands to the north to fight the Japanese in 43-45, thus disposing Australia had never sent conscripts to fight overseas. I didn't know we had the militia people in, they were conscripts. I didn't know that. But the National Service scheme reintroduced in November 64 was not introduced in the Vietnam service in mind, and for no other reason than the simple fact the government had not made any such commitment. Okay, so we didn't introduce the NASHOs. That's an interesting aspect. The only Australian personnel serving in Vietnam at that stage were officers and NCOs, senior NCOs of the Australian training team Vietnam, long service, regular soldiers, every last one of them. So there's lots of VCs. This is the true, the early 60s were a true involvement. In November 64, no main force contribution to Vietnam had been entered into. Indeed, it's quite clear. It's interesting that we had NASHOs, but the NASHOs preceded the Vietnam War. It's quite clear from the archival record that when future policy was discussed in advance of military talks in Hawaii at the end of 65, March 65, at that stage, no decision had yet been made, not least because the government's senior military advisers were still unclear about the course of action that the Americans themselves were likely to take. Of greater moment still was the unfolding situation in the underclear war between Malaysia and Indonesia, the Confrontasi. That's pretty much. President Sukarno had dubbed 64 a year of living dangerously. The Indonesian actions in the second half of the year had lived up to this designation with assaults launched in the peninsula of Malaya and the intensification of activities in the waters around Singapore. The prospect of conventional war in the region involving Indonesian and British, Australian and New Zealand forces aiding Malaysia seemed to be a real possibility at the end of the year. The first national servicemen killed in action died in Vietnam, but small numbers of national servicemen were deployed to Malaysia with their units in as early as 66 in advance of the first deployment to Vietnam in the middle of that year. Nor was the Vietnam a conscripts war in the sense that the army fought a war mainly with national servicemen. And that is absolutely true. I think there's only one army reservist died. The casualty is one army service. I think there's the Nashos, as we call them, were easier to kill at these various points. The figures have long been generally available and clearly implications the ratios deplored. Approximately 50,000 Australians served in over the waters surrounding Vietnam, of whom 17,224 were national servicemen. That's less than half. The army policy was to maintain a ratio of regulars to national servicemen at 50-50. 274 regulars were killed as opposed to 200 national servicemen. Well, there you go. But see, that number is not actually combat. I don't believe it's combat. So that gives you under 500. While the figures wounded were more servicemen, with respect. National servicemen played an important and honourable part in the Army's long commitment to Vietnam, but in no way, shape or form were them cannon fodder, as sometimes alleged. The second part of the chapter considers the position of the soldiers after they return from active service and discusses a number of veteran issues that have enjoyed a high level of visibility in the wider community at various times. The images of dysfunctional former soldiers seemingly seconds from unleashing extreme violence in homicidal rage on an uncomprehending civilian world around them is a default position for portrayal of Vietnam-era veterans by American popular culture. Seeing as Sylvester Stone portrayals of the Rambo series, it is a worldwide mark where American veterans are concerned and is readily accepted by the Australian context, almost entirely unrelated to them in the origin, says worrying things about the willingness of the general public to believe just about anything if packaging a certain way.
So I had, I was trained by Vietnam service sergeants. Well, I don't know, they were off, NCOs in Vietnam and sergeants, drill sergeants, and they would say that, you know, like when they came back, the university soldiers would fling, not the university soldiers, university students would fling dog poo at them. So that sounds bad, but, you know,
that's a story much more closer to the truth. Most widespread and persistent belief attached to the Australian Vietnam veterans is that none received a welcome home upon return to Australia. Allied to this is the perception, rather better grounded, that the soldiers returning from Vietnam received a hostile reception or at best were greeted with a complete indifference by their families. The Welcome Home March, well, this is interesting because I know people who had dog poo thrown at them in the dog in the Welcome Home March, held in Sydney, October 1987, is thus hailed by many as the march we didn't have. Oh dear. The unfavourable comparisons are drawn so strongly implied with early generations of Australian soldiers, once again a case of being made for supposed uniqueness of Vietnam service experience. All these views are inaccurate to the greater or lesser extent. It's complicated, but look, the entire thing is that Australia is not just taking down veterans. They take down everyone. They take down intellectuals, anyone who's slightly different. They just take them down. So yeah, it is tough, but look, it's really tough being anybody in Australia. They really take you down. Every battalion that served in Vietnam received a welcome home march upon its return to the capital of its home state. Soldiers of supporting units, such as artillery, army and aviation, who returned with battalions, participated in these marches on occasion as well. At least some ship's companies also received welcome home marches after returning from deployments to the gun line off the coast of Vietnam. Not every Australian soldier participated in the parade. Soldiers returned clearly because of illness and wounds. Men who joined the battalion in an individual reinforcement, one thus rotated home alone or in small groups. And those men who returned in Qantas flights generally did not receive attention. National servicemen might, or might not participate in some cases, battalions disembarked them in their home capitals on the way to the ship's final destination in order that they be processed out of the army more quickly and returned to the families. A good example of a well-intentioned policy with unintended consequences. A battalion marched through Sydney, for example, might have dropped some of its nashos in Perth and risen on the way, and these men missed out, while those in New South Wales, Victoria, for example, were still with the battalion when the HMS Sydney was docked in Garden Island and thus took part in the welcome. This was consistent with early practice, albeit from different reasons. Soldiers overseas in 1919 were repatriated and demobilised based on point systems. Soldiers earned points based on a number of factors, such as length of service and civilian employment. Men returned on troop ships in batches, and the early groups certainly received a welcome parades upon their return, but they did not march as or with their units, something that Australian General Monash had wanted to ensure, but on which he was overruled.
So this is the entire thing, because which is such a big country and all the units were all mixed up. They really, really did Anzac Day to redo the march. And
I don't know what this marching thing is. As more groups returned, marches trailed off. One suspects that there was little formal receptions for those men still returning for whatever reason in 1920, while those who were repatriated because of wounds and sickness during the course of the war likewise received no formal march in welcome. Contingents leaving for the war also often received send-offs, but those dwindled by the middle of the years of the war, and not all reinforcements to the front were fated on departure by any means. Support for the Australian involvement in Vietnam was in the majority, as things are measured in opinion polls, until sometime in 1969. And there was always a strong core of support for soldiers themselves, even when opposition to our involvement itself increased. The large numbers of protested in the three big moratorium campaigns in 1970-71 tends to obscure the fact that even larger numbers of Australians did not participate. In other words, anti-war activism was not the only universally subscribed to. It was a minority position. Oh dear. In any case, the welcome home marches accorded to the returning battalions were large, well-received events and by no means confined to officialdom and immediate families. With a couple of exceptions, they appear to have been free of protest and disruptions, even towards the end of Australian involvement.
Although the Adelaide one had the big dog poo throwing.
The author's own father returned from Vietnam in early 51, and his battalion marched through Sydney, greeted by a large enthusiastic crowd. I do not recall, and I cannot find mention of protest, despite the fact that the moratorium was at the heart of its time. Well, you haven't spoken to all the vets, have you? The best known protest to greet a returning battalion, ironically, came at the very beginning of the argument, and it is well known because it was caught on film and has been endlessly replayed in documentaries about Australia in the 1960s. On its return in June 66, the 1st Battalion to serve, 1 RAR, marched through Sydney, and a young woman covered in red paint ran out to the crowd, embraced the commanding officer. As evidence of available, suggests that she was acting alone for reasons of her own. Many of those participating in the march were unaware of anything amiss until the after the march had ended. The images captured at this moment are often regarded as symbolic, but whatever they represent, it is not, in general, representative of a welcome home accorded to soldiers who marched on those occasions.
I should say that the RARs, Royal Australian Regiment, so there's 6 RAR and 3 RAR, so 1 means it's from Sydney, 3 means it's from, 2 from Queensland, 3 from Victoria, 5 from South Australia, I don't know what the different ones, RARs, but the RARs are parachute regiments, and these people are just amazing. So we'd be in Pakapunyal, the RAR would be there, and they'd be just flinging their packs in the back of trucks, so no point. And we'd lift up the same pack and we'd be staggering.
So the By this stage, these soldiers were quite elite. It is certainly true that some soldiers received hostile receptions upon return, though it is impossible to know how widespread this was. Well, I don't know why. Some veterans recall individual actions of hostility, ignorance, and cowardly attacks at parties in front of others, or occasionally harassment by phone or mail. Others report feeling let down by the inability to convey their experiences around them, and the lack of comprehension of family and friends. This latter is a very common occurrence, and by no means confined to Vietnam experience. Many survivors of service in the two world wars bottled up their experiences for decades, while friends and families, eager to get on with their lives interrupted by war, showed little or no interest in war stories. There is also anecdotal evidence suggesting that young Vietnam veterans were given the cold shoulder by local RSL. Absolutely, there's still that Vietnam and RSL are still. Again, it's impossible to know how common widespread this is. Why not? And easily to read curlish individual responses are reflective of the institution as a whole, which they're not. But some veterans, at least, perceived that way, and who is to say they were wrong? The soldiers returning for service in the Korean War in the early 50s received similar responses on occasions.
Well, I do think so. I think the Vietnam people really hate the RSL.
Okay.
So the RSL's well-organized, nice people. They're trying to do the best. Yeah, it's hard to say.
No, it's really hard to say. But the Vietnam veterans and the RSL are separate organizations. Some Vietnam veterans certainly believed the RSL and the relevant government departments responsible for veterans' entitlements were less than sympathetic or understanding to their problems. And this led to the formation of the Vietnam Veterans Association, the VVA, in 1918. As the association's website describes, in the early years of existence, there was a real feeling that the RSL had not accepted the Vietnam veterans, and nor would it pursue the concerns of the group with the vigour they believed the concern warranted. This feeling was never stronger during this period when the VAA and the RSL was absolutely opposed. Oh dear. Contrary to popular belief at the times, its own self-image, the RSL has never been the only face of Australian veterans, and indeed, even at the heart of World War II, many of those eligible for membership chose not to belong, for whatever reason. It was certainly enjoyed considerable political influence at various times in history, its seniors official exercising direct access to prime ministers as diverse as Menzies and Hawke, but no longer, and has a long honourable record of supporting members and their families, especially when in need of assistance.
That is for absolute sure. And so that's essentially what the RSL is. It's a basically a looking after. It's like in Australia, it's a very negative society, and the RSL is a very positive, quiet, listening thing. That's what I can say.
It has also adopted a self-appointed role as a conservative guardian of social political mores on those issues it felt entitled to speak, such as the desirability of conscription, defence policy more generally, Asian immigration to Australia, no longer. These views have always garnered more media attention than its philanthropic role, and that's its major thing. As is well known, the membership of the VVAA was galvanised by and organised around a range of specific issues that its members felt were specific to them and their service, which they also felt were not accorded attention they deserved from government. Having concluded that the RSL would not help or would not help them in a manner they sought, they began high-profile, sometimes highly effective lobbying of politicians and state and federal level, drawing heavily on activities of veterans groups in the United States and often picking up on issues and information produced in those quarters. The activism of the VAA focused on several issues, most specifically the alleged impact of chemicals utilized in defoliation programs in the war.
So just to give you an idea, the major war production of Agent Orange, which is a defoliant, is in Sydney Harbour, produced by Union Carbide, and of course, if they had any extras, they just dumped them in Sydney Harbour. So you cannot eat any fish in Sydney Harbour. I think it is, there's one side of the Harbour Bridge you can fish off, the other side of the Harbour Bridge you can't really fish, you can fish off. That's due to the amount of agents.
Such chemicals, it was claimed, affected both the veterans and some of their children born after the return to service. as an incident of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which led to mental health issues, substance abuse, and suicide at rates much higher than the wider community. Once again, the clear inference of much of the lobbying activity and the intended publicity that Vietnam's service was unique and its consequences dissimilar from anything which previous generations of veterans had encountered. This general proposition doubtless chimed well with the view of the Vietnam War widely held by the Australian Labor Party. At the time it was in opposition federally, but several of its members, notably Clyde Holding, became parliamentary champions of the VAA positions, especially those concerned with chemical exposure. So I think this is true. The fruits of activism proved mixed. The term PTSD was coined in the mid-70s and recognized phenomenon that is now well known in military medicine, albeit by other names such as shell shock, battle fatigue, and non-Pacific neurasthenia. I can't pronounce that. The National Vietnam Veteran Readjustment Study conducted in the United States in 83 found that 15.2% of males and 8.5% of female Vietnam veterans presented with symptoms of PTSD. The gradual response to the findings in the United States, with the condition added to the Diagnostic Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, which conferred formal recognition that enabled veterans to claim conditions through the Veterans Association, was paralleled by developments in Australia. Crucial amendments were made to the repatriation legislation to bring provisions that could apply to Vietnam veterans into conformity with those applied to veterans of earlier wars. This would also lead to the creation of Vietnam Veterans Counselling Service and the establishment of the PTSD clinics at Heidelberg and Sydney. So Heidelberg was a huge repat hospital. So a lot of people, a lot of veterans were actually broken by the Japanese, the World War II veterans. So in the 80s, these people were, so they were okay, but they had a lot of physical issues from the time. So their recovery was not 100% from Vietnam. So they were up in Heidelberg. There's also a huge repat hospital in Adelaide. Just downwind from this huge abattoir, so it's all, the smell was just horrendous. So far, so good. Those involved will point to the protracted nature of the arguments and disagreements of the Fraser government over the needs of such facilities in the first place, which served in return to heighten the antagonism and growing sense of paranoia displayed by some veterans towards the whole process. There was also initially confusion about the causes of PTSD among the veterans' advocates, and attempts were made to link it to exposure to chemical agents, a condition labelled as toxic brain dysfunction. As with the pursuit of the Royal Commission into chemical agents and the profound disillusion which followed with the rejection of VAA's claims, the instance of novel nature of Vietnam service did those most in need of assistance a severe disservice. The repatriation system had recognized that war service would have hidden the consequences not immediately apparent or related to obvious wounding as far back as 1936. With the introduction of the concept of burnt-out digger, which in turn followed a similar development in Canada, the terms were different, but the concepts were not. Nor, as a wider acceptance, the war-related PTSD has helped by individuals making claims through the Veterans Entitlement Act of 86, process for pensions for alleged cases of PTSD that were fraudulent. Mm-hmm. The broader issue of bogus veterans, so-called wannabes, is discussed further below. So, this is dreadful, dreadful thing. Without question, there's a central issue of Vietnam service and its consequent problems as exposure to chemical agents and organised around the label Agent Orange. The term refers, of course, to one of the major defoliant agents, a group as a whole, sometimes known as rainbow herbicides, used by the Americans to strip vegetation from tens of thousands of hectares of South Vietnam in order to deny the cover to the enemy. Enormous quantities of herbicide were dropped in between 61 and 71, some 12 million gallons. The major recipients of the program's products were the Vietnamese, and claims concerning widespread birth defects among civilian populations came a staple of Hanoi's war of words with Washington during the years of diplomatic isolation after the war's end. Although straying missions continued for the length of the US presence in the country, their incidence declined markedly in 1969. The US Air Force official study makes several references to spraying missions of Phoc Thai province, especially during 1966. Scientific concern of the possible effect of herbicides and their links to a range of diseases and birth defects emerged in the 1970s, originally driven by research in Europe related to the incidence of soft tissue cancers among groups such as forestry workers. The problems with the area was that it was extremely difficult to prove or disprove allegations of links between chemicals, cancers, birth defects, since, by definition, experimental work could not be undertaken on human subjects. The VAA activism seized upon such findings and extrapolated them to sometimes tragic circumstances facing individual Vietnam veterans and their families. Disproportionate analysis has not helped by wildly exaggerating claims to the effect that well in excess of 110,000 Australian veterans, that is, fully 20% of those deployed, were seriously ill as a result of exposure to herbicides. Veteran lobbying produced a number of inquiries and reports, none of which served the purpose they had desired for them by confirming the positions they held. The media was far less critical and far more willing to demonise the chemical company's herbicide usage, and any public or scientific figure who expressed scepticism concerning VVAA's lines. In 1982, Senate inquiry found that links to birth defects, psychiatric problems and cancers were highly improbable, unlikely or inconclusive. Labor nonetheless undertook, before 1983, federal election to convene a royal commission on the issue and duly implemented this promise when elected.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.